Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbolista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. Hog, Penny Hog, at home with the Hogs.
Yes, indeed, it's us. Hello, welcome, and how are you? I am Kit.
And I'm Pen. Morning.
And we're delighted to have your company for the next 2 hours of story, satire and song here at home with us on the radio magazine that is well known for joining Expatria with Deep Spain. Well, I think...
The
first thing...
I just say something very quickly?
Yes.
I wanted to say hello to a bionic man, my bionic dad, who might be listening right here, right now, and well done, Dad. He just had some heart stuff done and stuff done here and there and is getting well, and good morning all.
Yes, good morning all, and well done, Pete, yeah. And we've had a drop of rain here, which has just been absolutely amazing.
Glory.
Yeah, praise the Lord, alhamdulillah. Now we can welcome what the campesinos call the retorno, which is the return.
The return of life.
It's already starting to green up.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, just honestly,
little
overnight.
Little tiny
overnight.
Shoots of recovery,
yeah,
like
delicious.
The economy. Ha ha. Now, what have we got on the programme today? Well, we'll be telling you about our weekend in Barcelona, last weekend, which, just in case you missed us, is why we weren't here last week.
Nobody noticed the thing, it's all right, babe.
I don't know, I think we might have missed. We go to a book launch.
We go to a book launch and we meet Maria Jose Sevilla and talk about her book Deliciosa. And I'm going to read a delicious...
A delicioso extract.
Yes, which is a little bit gruesome. You need a strong stomach. So eat breakfast first and then listen.
No, I think it's got some ideas for breakfast there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is following an interview with a poor telephone connection 2 weeks ago.
Yes, and that was a bit unfortunate.
It was a little, yes. It is the case that with climate change, our Mediterranean summers are now a good 5 weeks longer than they were 30 years ago. Although nothing to do with weather patterns, the same tendency for growth could be attributed to Christmas, a season with a longevity stretching from October to mid-January, now fortified by the increasing popularity of an institution called the Christmas Fair, a phenomenon we'll be looking at around 11:45 on the show today with fair organiser
Karen O'Connor.
And just after the news at noon, we're joined by Janie Jewson.
Janie's going to be talking to us about the Samaritans here in Spain. We spoke to Jilly from the Samaritans earlier in the year, and Jane Jusen has become a volunteer, and it's about life on two sides of the phone.
Now, if I told you I had a bad attack of Dothiorella, or bacterial blast, you might think it was something I ate. But
such
no.
Such a hypochondriac, babe.
Along with citrus nematode and sooty mould. These are common complaints among orange and lemon trees. You hear them talking to each other, don't you? Wow, what a terrible attack of sooty mould. Anyway, at long last, better late than never, Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens addresses the pests and diseases that affect citrus health. That's in the second hour of this programme. After which, Andy Wood joins us from New Jersey with news and views on Black Friday, Thanksgiving, and a certain impeachment that's going on. So what is the only radio programme that combines a faux pas at a book launch with citrus nematodes, a Christmas fair with a call to the Samaritans, and a lock-in at a Barcelona fish restaurant with scrotal lumps?
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Is the right answer. Thank you for that. And let's go straight to those scrotal lumps, something you don't have to worry about if you're a woman.
It's a bit early for scrotal lumps.
Well, it's not just about scrotal lumps, actually. It's
no, much more important.
It's a kind of a develops into a bit of an Andalus moment, this particular yarn. Now, let's start with rugby, because I'm sure even if you're not a fan, you're aware that 3 weeks ago, South Africa won the World Cup. And if you saw their final match against England, you can't fail to have noticed the smallest guy on the pitch, the mercurially irrepressible flaxen-haired Springbok scrum half, Faf de Klerk, who must be really irritating to play against. Anyway,
because he's so good.
Yeah, he's so good.
And he's that guy who's got his, he walks with his feet out, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's a bit cocky.
He's a bit of a pretty boy. He's always in your face. And he's just really good, you know. Anyway, for several days after the game, the South Africans went wild with celebrations, during most of which Faf partied in showers of champagne, clad in no more than a pair of budgie-smuggling Speedo swimming trunks, the colours of the South African flag, an outfit in which he not only met Prince Harry for some reason. I don't know what Prince Harry was doing there. But more significantly, he launched a campaign called Be Ballsy. Now, Be Ballsy is a challenge to men to get over themselves and get checked for testicular cancer, a potential for embarrassment that blokes would rather forget about, which is something of a coincidence, because without burdening you with too much info, the other morning I woke up with a lump that shouldn't be there. Two, all well and good, but three... What was that doing there? Faf came to mind. And so it was yesterday that I was... yesterday found me in an attempt to make an appointment, standing in front of six grey-suited women with computer screens in the foyer at Hospiten reception, one of whom was eyeing me inscrutably. It was my turn. "See," she said, "time to front up and be ballsy." Now, I'd taken the trouble to Google testicular lump previously, and after a cursory glance at the lurid cartoons, went to Google Translate, which came up with bulto escrotal. So armed with this phrase, which I'd actually written down in lowered tones, I leant over the desk and told the receptionist, "Quiero ver un médico en el tema de un bulto escrotal." She actually
funny.
Looked up at me without comprehension. And she said, "Como?" In an urgent undertone, I repeated my request. Obviously, this wasn't going as smoothly as I'd hoped. To which she said, "Bulto escrotal, eso que es." Quite loudly. This was turning into an Andalus moment. And so, irritated now, I became Andalus, uninhibitedly so. "Mira," I said, "yo tengo un saco, y dentro de ese saco no solo hay dos cajones, pero un bultito que no me gusta, y quiero ver un médico lo más antes posible." By now, three of the other grey-suited young women, attracted by my self-prognosis, had gathered round to enlighten their colleague and arrange an appointment. I'll keep you posted. But, you know, events like that is one reason why blokes are inhibited. I mean, it's all part of being ballsy, I suppose, these medical disclosures.
Well, I do think these receptions, yes, the reception area of any hospital is... I remember being in some... I think Mary Stags, I wonder if she's still about in Estepona. Long time ago, I was in this waiting room, this alternative health practitioner, and she came bursting out of this surgery, you know, her surgical room, and she just yelled across there, he's got swollen nipples. This poor boy in the surgery, the whole reception looks at this guy and just straight at his breasts, which the poor boy was right. But, you know, there was no privacy at all. You know,
no, professionals, it's not, really, you it's are, not to the thin skin.
Yes, you know. Yes, definitely.
You can go to the Pueblo, the waiting room, the medical waiting room.
Yeah,
the Pueblo.
Everybody's eyeing each other up,
yeah,
aren't they?
Está malo por qué? And I'm, actually, to the other punters, you can lie. But what you can't do is lie to a receptionist who's lining you up with a specialist, because if you lie, you'll get the wrong specialist.
And you have to say. You're expected to know what the problem is. If you've got a pain, well, is that going to be urinary? Is it going to be gastro? Is it gynecological? You just don't know. So you have to pick your specialist. I've never quite got that.
The Chinese are much more discreet. The Chinese have, yes, a picture of a sort of naked reclining person, and you're invited to point to the area of the body that is causing you problems.
So I do.
You immediately lined up with a urologist, or I don't know. But anyway, you
can
had
I
a bit.
Can I just say the last medical thing? Then, because people might be eating their brunch. Thanks. I was feeling a little unwell.
I was going to say you had a medical event, didn't you?
Yes,
on a recent flight.
On a recent, claustrophobic flight. I'm welling. Thank you very much. With feeling very, very unwell in my stomach, and there was a baby screaming on the other side of the aisle. We were packed in like sardines, as you can imagine, after hours of queuing. Felt a bit dizzy. I said, I think I'm going to vomit. So I nudged my husband. I said, babe, get me a sit bag. And he produces this newspaper. I'm just about to go. He goes, no, not there. That's a sports page. I haven't read it.
Wait. You might have smudged the print. Yes, and then a very small and hopelessly inadequate bag was produced. I mean, how you're supposed to aim into that bag?
Jolly.
I have no
idea. It was so jolly. Anyway,
yeah, flights to remember. But which brings us to our weekend in Barcelona, in fact. And on the way, I have to make a restaurant recommendation here.
Yeah, I think you should.
I mean, when you stop outside a restaurant and park between a Maserati and a Porsche Cayenne, from which are emerging Gucci-clad occupants in winter furs and the unfortunate mustard-coloured corduroy trousers, which seem to be de rigueur in a Spanish winter, your wallet might begin to whimper and the word pijo might pop into your head. Pijo means posh. But I've learnt in Spain that posh doesn't necessarily need to be expensive. Posh is just proper.
Posh is classy.
Yes, there's class. That's right. And especially at a pijo restaurant, posh is quality. You might pay more than you would at a scrummage school dinner of Menú del Día, but inherent to the concept of quality is value, just beyond which is the territory, the rarefied uplands of generosity, which is actually a characteristic that illuminates the traditional Spanish roadhouse of El Higuerón. You might actually know it. It's in on the Mijas Benalmádena intersection, just off the Autovía, and well handy as a stop-off on your way to or from the airport, which was the context of our visit last Saturday. I mean, check this out. We had... Can you remember what we had for breakfast, babe?
Not really.
She hasn't got an idea. I'll tell you then. We had two plates, remember? Two plates of fried eggs and ham on. You had one, I had the other. Bread rolls, coffee, a large orange juice for just 15 euros. And it was promptly served by a waiter in a long black apron in a sunlit dining room with polished floorboards and huge views. 15 euros? I mean, we said, you've got to be joking, didn't we?
Yeah. It was a very, very,
you know,
very good
made
price.
A mistake. Anyway, so restaurant El Higuerón, Benalmádena, unashamed recommendation to this fine establishment of good eating, kilometre 217. The Fabada Asturiana is riquísimo, but that's a kind of lunchtime thing. Breakfast, fantastic. So let's get to the airport now. We're on our way to Barcelona, and here's a tip. you're waiting, you probably don't need this tip, but if you're kind of lazy and like to stand out from the crowd like we do, you need bringing into nine.
You haven't said about the boarding passes.
Oh, tell us about the boarding passes, my love, because this was actually kind of a breakthrough, wasn't it?
It was.
Into modernity.
We are smartphone virgins, but we did it. We had the boarding card on the phone, confidently, and like my sister said, you've got to be nonchalant about it. You have the boarding pass on that, and you just press it, give it to the cheek as you go through to the security gate, and ping, it worked. Couldn't believe it. It was, yeah, we were so cool. So we've upped a notch in our travelling now.
And miraculously, my phone stayed on. It normally turns off, and then you have to press various buttons.
Yeah, mine didn't.
Sort of swiping to get,
it was reasonably successful, not too fumbly.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Still don't trust it, though.
So anyway, we've got through that part, and we're waiting for our flight to that final departure desk, you know, the one where the smiling women in suits and neck scarves check your credentials before admitting you to the umbilical tunnel affixed to the fuselage, which digests passengers before depositing them in their seats on the plane. But long before this process begins, people are queuing. I mean, they sort of stand up when they could be sitting down.
Why?
I mean, you know, we were wondering that, weren't we? I mean, if you're English, you understand this, because as we all know, the English love queuing. But on a domestic flight to Barcelona, only a fraction of the passengers are English. And then the Spanish aren't renowned for waiting in line. Moreover, nearly everyone has an allotted seat number anyway. So what is the point of standing to be crushed and processed and potted into a knee-bruising confine of a chair on an aeroplane hours before takeoff? Well, the answer to this question we discovered last Saturday, smugly contrarian, the heifer and I making meh noises, watching people queuing like sheep,
yeah,
wheeling hand luggage that stretched the definition of hand luggage. I mean, isn't hand luggage so oversized these days?
Yeah, it's just not on.
Down they went, down the digestive tract that led to the plane, only to discover that by the time we were being greeted by the air stewards at the door of the aircraft, we were simultaneously relieved of our baggage. The overhead lockers were already full and our cases were taken into the hold, which isn't a problem until you find yourself, having landed at the other end, standing next to a glacially slow carousel at baggage reclaim, waiting for a suitcase, by which time those who'd had the foresight to join the queue on embarkation were well on their way with their hand luggage that had been stowed in the overhead locker to the gaudiest glory that embellishes that princess of European cities, Barcelona, who last week at any rate was surprisingly herself. No tsunami democracia lobbying Molotov cocktails, nor baton charging Policía Nacional. The only apparent disruption was a large camp of demonstrators fortified by a stockade of pallets blocking Gran Via, which we visited the following morning, didn't we? I mean,
we did.
It had obviously been a good night. It was absolutely silent.
Yeah, it was hardly
a load of snoring colony of mushroom tents, I remember writing in my little notebook. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself, because
I'm excited about this, babe. Yes. Well, where are we now? We're in Plaza de Catalunya.
I'm getting ahead of myself, because the meal we ate, I want to talk about the meal
we've
we ate on
time.
The Saturday
we've
night.
Got time.
Because it was excellent.
It was really excellent.
It was a very different scenario from El Higuerón. It was a fish restaurant in the born barrio of Barcelona called Rufo y Mari. And in spite of a reservation, the place was apparently closed when we arrived. Apparently because the large galvanized roller shutter securing the front of the premises had dropped to the floor randomly until we arrived immovably. It was dragged down into the closed position by a faulty braking mechanism and the force of gravity. Bang, clonk, stuck. So we had a lock-in of 80 people feeding inside and us wondering why on the pavement outside, why we couldn't get in. And then a side door opened and a large South American woman began grappling with the corrugations in an attempt to lift the unbudging shutter. Along with other family members, we all joined in, and Koibi, who's a flanker in the Spanish rugby team, proved uncommonly useful in this endeavour. He prized it open until the roller shutter jammed about a metre off the floor, and it was then that Penn noticed a live tautening electric cable that was caught in the mechanism, at which point Rufo, who was the proprietor, decided that we were in the way and we were shown
please
to our table.
Please go and sit down.
That's
thanks,
right.
Thanks
so we were enjoying it, weren't we?
Please go. Yeah.
Getting stuck in. So in we went to this dining room, which was a heaving room of happy diners, oblivious to their potential entrapment, noisily scoffing platefuls of rape, rosada, calamares, oysters, mejillones, and whatever else had been swimming in the sea that day. Now, the next morning was Penn's birthday. And because she's impossible to please, as in years gone by, she decided to go clothes shopping herself.
Can I just say a little thank you for my birthday present?
Well, I didn't actually give you one, darling.
No, you did. Yeah, we use it every evening.
Oh, yes, the early birthday present.
Was
an economy present, I have to say.
So, people, you have to guess what this is.
Make the noise.
I can't. Made of metal, wood, and leather. You do the noise, babe. An exquisite pair of old bellows. But nobody else got some of those for their birthday.
Particularly when they were found on the dump. I mean, normally you reject
it. So efficient. And another brilliant birthday present. So it's my turn now. A pencil sharpener. Oh, it's one of those old-fashioned ones that you fix to the desk. You put your pencil in, fix it, and you turn the little handle-y thing. And this exquisite, sharp, sharp pencil comes out. Yeah, you everybody has to have one. They're underrated pencils. I recommend them.
Don't you find that pencils, when they're really sharp, immediately break?
Well, it depends how hard you press them, but it could do, yeah.
For shading, light shading. Or
I don't really shade anything, but just I like to scribble, pretend I'm doing shorthand or something.
Anyway, let's go back to your birthday, and you decided that you wanted to go clothes shopping by yourself. Because any ability for me to select something for you was sort of shattered, you know, completely sort of ages ago. But in something of an oversight, we realized that it was Sunday, and even in Barcelona, Massimo Dutti, Zara, and American Vintage observe the Sabbath closed. But a barbero we passed was, however, open. The barber's shop, however inappropriate for Penn on her birthday, was just what I needed. Caught in the loyalty of frequenting a peluqueria on the Costa, I'd never been to a barber's in Spain, where the barbero is a relatively new phenomenon. At least I've only just noticed it. I gawped through the plate glass at hip millennials, snipping, clipping, shaving, preening, plucking, and embalming with hot towels, walls adorned by boxing memorabilia, hip-hop, then James Brown floating out of the door. I wondered how I would fit in this vestibule of modern masculinity, because what I could see in the plate glass window was unpromising, a reflection of a 60-something with geography teacher hair, horrible floppy side parting, strands of grey wire in unruly thatches sticking out of his scalp, a baby boomer in need of a serious makeover. I went in. No one said a thing. The vibe was indiscriminatory cool. Everyone just carried on. Three punters reclining, swiveling, soaking up the minuscule attention to each bristle detail being lavished upon them by the three tattooed, adorned barbers, the youngest of whom was now brushing his client down, bidding him farewell. It was my go, but before addressing me, he swept and dustpanned the floor. Like the Mahatma Gandhi cleaning his own lavatory, the barbero in a humble rite of hygiene. He then turned, smiled sweetly, and gave me a blokey handshake. He told me his name was Bryn, and sat me down in front of the mirror. ¿Qué hacemos? He asked, without a trace of alarm at the dishevelment staring back at us. Whew, well, where to begin? Next to me, I looked to my right, where an Indian dude in the mirror right next door was emerging from chrysalis to butterfly, from mortal to reclining Buddha. His beard, like an architectural drawing, was clipped to perfection. His hair, like a felt hat, gripped the top and sides of his head as though precision machined, which of course it just had been. And I told Bryn, I want to look like him. A lesser barber might have been overwhelmed by this challenge or says something like, you're having a laugh. But unflinchingly, Bryn went straight to the compañero barbero who was performing this masterpiece of follicle surgery on Siddhartha next to us and came back with the info, which was 3.5.
Oh, is this?
Like the meaning of life being 42. Do you
so
remember?
He's asking what was the thing on his blade.
Yeah,
right.
That was a secret. But you remember in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when
they wanted to know
the meaning of life.
Answer to the universe.
Yeah. And we came up with 42.
Secret of the universe, yeah.
So it reminded me of that. 3.5. Yeah, that was the clipper adjustment that would ensure my renewal. But before that, with no shampoos, which is interesting. No, none of
them. Yes, I think that makes sense.
None of them, like, well, can we wash your hair? But just a squeeze.
We'll just cut it off.
My hair was not clean.
Yeah.
Just squeezy bottle. Like, and
cut my hair off. So much easier than washing it. Yeah.
But the preparation was what was extraordinary. So the squeezy bottle in one hand, comb in the other. He began vigorously parting and reparting the top of my head, shaping and defining the ley lines of my hair with impressive exactitude. It was a process of exploration, really.
It had to be.
And it went on for several minutes. And only when he was fully acquainted with my hair and a game plan did he reach for the scissors, impressively spinning them Smith and Wesson style, and really did, like a sharpshooter contemplating his next alchemy. And what a nice guy that Bryn was.
He was.
I know he's not listening, but he's the sort of guy you'd like to take home with you.
Yes, I'm sure you would.
He's from Vigo.
Vigo, yes.
And he learned to be a barbero just 1.5 years ago and spent some time in New York.
Did he?
Working.
Learning it?
Yeah.
I would explain the NYC tattoos on his left hand.
Did he? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I did.
But I just think there's something quite bonding about it. I could bond with a barbero.
It's, I don't think it's that rare, actually. A lot of people do go to barbers, but what?
No, well, I don't. So I haven't up till now.
What do you think about this? Have you finished your reading? What I was going to say,
the hot towel was just amazing. Yeah, so you're lying on your back in the chair, and then it's hot towel time, and you wonder quite what's going on because your face has become shrouded in this embalmment.
Yeah,
and that's in preparation for the shave.
The
shave is like this little scratchy sensation of an open blade.
Darling, we must get out more.
I tell you what, if I had a fluorescent puffer jacket, because he did take the sides in, didn't he?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen Autumn Watch, but if I had a fluorescent puffer jacket, I would look just like Chris Packham.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Now, you may have heard the interview 2 weeks ago with Maria Jose Sevilla on this programme. She's the author of a brand new book called Delicioso, A History of Food in Spain. Well, you may have heard some of it. The phone was playing up. My apologies, of course. I should have hung up and tried again. I did actually consider this, but it felt beyond the fluency of the studio duffer at that time. Too deft to manoeuvre. So we battled on. And having endured the debacle at Home with the Hogs, Maria had every expectation that they would turn up for her book launch last Friday, which we did, mingling with the sweet cognoscenti of the Campo de Gibraltar and the local literary enclave from the Serenia de Ronda in a lovely Almunia garden. Vino flowed and tapas were delicious. And because I was talking with a mouthful, I inadvertently spat a speck of padron pepper onto the blouse of Maria herself, who, sparing me embarrassment, pretended not to notice. Now, isn't this a problem? I mean, I wonder if you suffer from this problem when you're eating and drinking and talking intently to somebody, standing up normally in a sort of cocktail party type, the drinks party type scenario. I mean, if you elicit a G, G, or a C, K, consonant while eating without, how can you do that without showering your interlocutor? I mean, especially at our time of life when you've got less teeth than you used to have.
Well, the answer is not to eat anything.
Everybody's eating. I mean, yeah, that's a bit parsimonious. No. I mean, yeah. I wonder what the etiquette is here. When do you look away when you're going? Isn't it cold to look away, or you cover your mouth with a raised hand?
No, generally, I'm really bad at standing up and socialising. I don't like standing up and mingling. I'm a sitter downer.
Well, you don't eat anything anyway, no, so you don't have that problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess you probably will just have to practice in front of the mirror, eating vol-au-vents in front of the mirror.
Anyway, what did you do?
Actually, what I did was I found myself just removing this item of Padron Pepper from her blouse. And I just, at first time I'd met her, she was so sweet. Without really drawing attention to it, I just reflexed and my hand went up.
Stroked her breast.
And
yes.
pretty much, yeah. And it was totally cool.
But yeah, she is cool.
But anyway, we're going to have a book. We're going to have an excerpt.
Anyway, this is about
lovely
her.
Book.
Yeah, it's a fantastic Christmas present. But it's quite a read. And she says
here... Well, you're not going to read all of it, are you, bub?
I'm going to start.
Once upon a time.
Writing a comprehensive book about the history of Spanish food has been a challenge. I am a Spanish food writer who lives abroad, fascinated by my own country and my culture, and who has found in social history an answer to the way I cook and like to eat. For the last 30 years, this fascination has created in me an attachment to the subject of Spanish food and wine that, in the ways of those in exile, voluntary in my case, has grown stronger through living outside the land of my birth. Sharing Spanish food and wine with others, travelling, cooking and writing books on the subject has helped me along the way and allowed me to keep in touch with my origins at a time when food has been changing dramatically in Spain. And I suppose that's since Franco days. But this is a little extract that this is about halfway through the book, which is an amazing history, but it's about, this is on the chapter on Madrid, Versailles, Naples and best of all, chocolate. I haven't got to the chocolate bit, but meanwhile, the forgotten cuts of meat. Offal.
Oh, delicious. Right, let's go.
Offal is found in many recipes of the cocinas de España. There are liver, kidneys, trotters, black pudding, tripe, brains, oxtail, fresh and salted bones, and sweetbreads, among others. Offal has always been available from specialised local shops known as casquerias, normally located in covered markets. They still attract a segment of the ageing population who grew up eating and cooking offal with regularity. As the country progressed and the diet of Spaniards improved in the early 1960s, offal started to lose popularity in large towns and cities, especially with the middle classes and the young. Manitas de cerdo or del cordero, lamb or pig's trotters, are delicately prepared in La Rioja. Marrow bones and other bones, fresh or salted, are favoured by those who enjoy marrow and gelatinous textures. Lamb brains are sold nowadays individually packed in small purpose-made containers that protect the delicate skin. Long gone are the days when fried brains covered with flour and beaten egg were given to children and the infirm. They are now only demanded by those with a discerning palate. Tongue is normally stewed with carrots, onion and white wine. Veal liver still commands a fair price in the markets, while pig's liver is fast losing ground, as are lamb kidneys. Even if they're prepared a la jerezana, cooked with a generous glass of sherry. Oh, I think that's enough, babe. I can't read any more of this. It's not giving me an appetite, no.
I am reminded of the breakfasts that Piche used to eat. Piche was a guy... we used to work with.
Yes.
And breakfast, 10:30, he'd open up his Tupperware and there would be gelatinous grey pieces of tripe which actually matched the Tupperware. We've got Janet on the line. How nice. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. There's a wonderful recipe in Mallorca that's called frito mallorquín.
Tell us.
And it's made up of all the lung, the liver, the lights and everything, which are all fried. And then you fry potatoes. They're all cut up small potatoes, red peppers, garlic, and another veg which you might fancy artichokes, and all sorts of peas and things. And it's all mixed together. And then you put fresh fennel leaves, cut up small, quite a lot.
Yes, I love fennel with meat dishes, particularly pig.
Yeah, and this is probably one of the most famous Mallorcan dishes.
Well, what's it called again, Janet?
Frito.
Frito.
Like fried, Mallorcan fried dish.
Frito Mallorquín.
Frito Mallorquín.
Okay.
Which is probably,
and then
probably
also tongue with capers.
Ah. Oh. Right. So let's talk about the frito mallorquín firstly. That sounds like a sort of pot dish where in days of yore you would put in leftovers or think scraps that you didn't quite know what to do with.
Well, you know, it's just the cheapest part of the meat. I mean, you could have in spring it would be the lamb. You'd have the lamb is innards, and then you'd have the pork innards. It depends, you see, on the time of year, and it depends.
Can you be a bit more specific when you use the word innard?
Well, literally everything, the lung and the liver, and
that's what offal is, I suppose.
And even they even put blood, because you can buy blood, dried blood. It's they cook the blood until it comes to sort of like a paste, you know. It's you can cut it into pieces.
Mm.
And that is also put in it sometimes.
The fact is, we can be squeamish about it, but nothing is wasted.
Nothing is wasted.
And is it actually good? Is it actually palatable?
It is really good.
What's it flavoured with, apart from the fennel?
Well, you have the garlic and the onion in it.
Yeah.
And salt and pepper, and that's it. And quite a lot of fennel.
Right, and it's a slow, bubbly brew, I imagine.
It's all fried separately and then put together.
Okay.
It's not. There's no juice to it exactly. You've just got the oil that you fried all the vegetables and the meat in.
Sorry, Janet, you mean a fennel bulb?
No, the fennel leaves.
Fennel leaves.
You know the
right.
The
very fine, fine
the very
leaves,
fine
they?
Leaves. Yes, they're all chopped up and you quite a lot in those. Put in because you use those here also with the snails that you eat.
So, what about the tongue and the capers?
The tongue is cooked. The tongue is cooked a long time, so it comes out like a ham almost, and it's cut in slices, and you make a sauce with capers, a caper sauce, and that's served up, the tongue with the capers on, you know, caper sauce on top, and that really is very nice too.
And how available are these dishes? Because one of the things that this book is talking about is that old recipes like this are in danger of dying out. I think that's one of the reasons why she wrote this book, was to try and preserve this tradition.
No, here they're in practically every Mallorcan restaurant. It's especially the, you know, where the Mallorcan people go. You go, you know, to the cellars, you know, they call them talleres. And definitely there's, and certain villages have different ways of making it. For example, in a village called Tineo, they cut the meat up very small, and the veg and the potatoes very small. In others, they're a little bit bigger. And some put red peppers, some don't, you know. So it depends on the village, and it's very extensive here, and the tongue with capers is also, and another thing called sopas mallorquinas, which is nothing to do with soup at all.
What is that?
It's actually made with bread. You have special bread. It's brown bread, you know, the payes, as they call it here, that's let to get stale and cut very, very thin.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you make a sofrito, which is the tomato and onion. You fry that together and then make a soup with lots of different veg. You put cauliflower, cabbage, red peppers, artichokes, and you make like a soup. And this you put on top of the bread. It's got to be a slightly spicy.
Mm-hmm.
You do a little bit of chili and a little bit of paprika.
So just briefly, Janet, because we're running out of time, can I ask you, would you find these dishes in a menu del día?
Yes.
You really would? Okay.
Yes.
So they haven't just been hijacked by trendy chefs?
No.
These are still really old
dishes.
Right. That's really good.
And Janet, are you a cook, a pro cook?
No. I just like cooking, and yeah. I just like eating, basically. If you should see the size of me, then you'd understand.
But I'm sure you're very healthy. Yeah, fantastic.
I'm super
I'm
healthy, as you can hear.
So, really appreciate that, Janet.
Yeah, thank
okay.
you.
Insight
have a
into
weekend.
Mallorquin cookery.
Bye.
Thank you so much. So, frito mallorquin, tongue and capers, and sopa mallorquinas. I imagine they're in that book. We don't have time to look, actually, but the book by Maria Jose Sevilla is called Delicioso. It's available on Amazon. It would make a wonderful Christmas present. Really, it's an eclectic and original study of traditional recipes, some of which, as Janet alluded to, still exist, some of which are dying out. And it's chronologically studied.
Yeah, it's more of
beautifully
a history,
produced, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's more of a history book than a recipe book, I would say. Definitely.
We are going to take a break now, and we're going to welcome two very special guests after these messages. We'll see you on the other side.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At Home with the Hogs.
Well, we've been joined by a good friend of the show. Always welcome Home with the Hogs. It's Janie Jewson. Janie, hi, good morning.
Good morning, Kit and Ben.
And thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you're going to be talking to us, revealing something of the work of the Samaritans.
Yes, very important charity that really does need to be talked about, actually.
Great.
And that's just after midday.
And that is after midday. But in the meantime, you're very welcome to sit with us as we go seasonal, because well before Christmas Day, just after the first twinkle of tinsel in Hypercor and the overseas shop, is a season that used to be known as Advent and has now reinvented itself as the season of the Christmas fair. And who better to tell us about this unique union of commerce and celebration than Karen O'Connor, who joins us now. Karen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Kurt. How are we?
We're good, thank you. And you, my dear?
I'm all right. I'm a little tired. Organising the Christmas fair and moving house at the same time has been a bit challenging this week, but we're getting there.
You're moving house. You left the mountains to go to the Costa, didn't you? Which is an unusual move.
I know. I needed, for my poor old bones, I needed it to be a little bit warmer in the winter. But no, we're just doing the house up and have to move out into a rental for a while. So, but it's fine. I just can't find anything.
So going back to the Christmas fair, Karen,
yes.
I mean, how many years have you been doing it?
I have been doing it for 12 years now. But it
no,
has,
that is a long time.
I know.
And sorry, Karen, going, what fair is this? We need to
it's
specify.
It's the Galsine Christmas Fair.
The Galsine Christmas Fair.
And it's now celebrating its 25th anniversary.
This
when
year.
It started out this year. And apparently it's the longest serving Christmas fair in the whole of Andalusia, I've been reliably told.
Yeah.
So hopefully, the oldest and the best, I think.
So what's the history of it? How is it? How would it compare then to how it is now?
Well, it started by a lady called Diana Paget at her house in Almunia, just outside Galsin.
Yeah.
So it basically started out as a get-together, you know, usually because everybody battens down the hatches in the winter, so it's kind of the last bit that you all got together before you resurfaced when the weather got nicer in March.
Yes.
And it was basically just a bar and a get-together and a few people selling their Christmas things, and it had lovely stalls, but it kind of just grown. It's grown and grown and grown.
And then it moved into the village.
Diana decided to retire for the house, and we sort of looked for somewhere, but I thought best to have it in the village because it basically was an expat type thing. We thought that if we brought it to the village, then we could get everybody involved.
Absolutely.
And it really
has that happened? Has it taken a long time?
It has It has happened. It's grown each year to the point where we're about 50-50 now with stalls. And
sorry, what do you mean 50-50, Karen?
About 50% was like before, you know, English and Dutch and artists. But now it's about 50% of Spanish have stalls and all artists, designers, which is just brilliant. We've got local foods and wines and beers that are all made locally, the local olive oil. They've all got stands, so it's kind of celebrating that's happening in the area as well.
So this is something that we have brought to Spain. The Guiris have brought this wonderful Christmas tradition, and the Spanish are going, all right, we'll give it a go. Yes?
Yes. It has. Yes, it's finally been recognised that it's you know, it's a get together, and it's everybody has a time. We've got music because we've changed venues this year because we always had it in the convent, but it's undergoing works and not completed. The mayor has kindly let us have the new Ayuntamiento, which is opposite the convent this year. So everybody who's been to the Christmas Red Fog knows it could be a bit chilly inside. You're going to be warm this year because it's a brand new building.
That's so absolutely brilliant.
20 pairs of socks.
Unless you happen to be outside with the food and drink, I suppose.
You can always buy some socks, I suppose, at one of the stores. There must be a sock sale there.
Yes, there's a sock store, don't worry.
In terms of integration, actually, it's been a very valuable tool and recognition.
I think it has. And I was really pleased this year, which kind of has nailed it for me, was that we have several charity stalls, and one of which is ADECA, which is the Gaussian charity.
Yeah.
And Linda, who runs it, approached the children of the school to paint pictures for a calendar, which has been made to sell on the ADECA stall to raise money for the animals. Yeah. So what they did was they had every child in the school has done a picture, and our well-renowned artist, called Joseba Sanchez Sabaleta, who's had exhibitions all the way around the world, picked the 12 winners, the 12
entries. Did he? Yeah.
Yes. And they've been made into a calendar. But what we're going to do is every picture is going to be put on the wall. So you can see over 100 pictures of all the children's efforts, which some are just make you laugh, and there are a couple that sort of,
I tell you what, Karen, I can think of another calendar which would certainly make people laugh of Gaussian.
No.
Oh, yes.
Do not go there.
Oh, I think it could be done.
Who? Are you talking about the Pilates?
Next year, not the Pilates.
We're not doing a calendar girl's title.
Oh, I was thinking of calendar boys, actually.
I wonder if that would catch on amongst the locals.
I am sure there's somebody sitting not too far of you happily,
suppose. On that bombshell, Karen, so it starts at next weekend, on the 30th.
Next weekend, Saturday, 10 till 5, and Sunday, 10 till 5. Can I add that the mayor has kindly let us celebrate the 25th anniversary, and we turn it into a little street party. He's closing off the street outside, and we're going to have music, live music, bar, restaurant, lovely seat. It's at every spend the time. Marcus on Saturday, the introduction of brand new band, the Poozy Brothers, and on Sunday,
they sound good.
They sound fantastic, don't they, Kit? And on Sunday, Mark Colley and the beautiful Jessing Elizabeth Cedar. So there's something for everybody, and
amazing.
We've got paella
it sounds like Woodstock with tinsel.
I'll go with that. I'll take that one.
Karen, I'm looking forward to
that. Karen, congratulations. I mean, even if it never happens, it's a wonderful concept in our imaginations. And I'm wondering if you're listening to us rabbiting away here, whether you have a Christmas fair in your pueblo, because they are catching on all over the TRE area.
And they are from very early on, I discovered.
I know.
Janie, you did one.
Janie
did one last year, last week, rather, didn't you?
2 weeks ago.
Two weeks.
Second week in November. Oh, my gosh, it really was. And I'm not really a Christmas fan, but I'm not a Mrs. Humbug either. So I was not that enthusiastic about it because, you know, tinsel and reindeers and Santa hats and everything this early in the year is a little bit too much
for
me.
Well, it was 2 weeks ago.
It was. And it was in a small little room in a club. But it was just British cheer, you know. Mm. There weren't any Spaniards there because I don't know. They don't do it, but it's a Spanish-named club. But yeah. There weren't any Spanish that went. But it was good fun and I enjoyed it. There was even a screen on the wall with a crackling fire, a live crackling fire. And we had mince pies and coffee, and there was all the sort of typical bumbling behind the tables at the back with all the club ladies sort of not knowing which toast was which and all this sort of thing. It was good fun, and I enjoyed it, but it's too early, sorry.
Yes.
I had my first mince pie last week, though, Janie, so I'm getting the spirit of things now.
Well, I did actually buy a cake and someone inadvertently left one on my table as well, so I'm already halfway through the first one.
I mean, I wonder whether the Christmas fair portrays the British as being more British than they would be if they were in Britain. Particularly when you're doing one in the middle of November. But anyway, Karen, the great thing about the Galsing Fair is what you're telling us is that it's proved to be a nexus of integration and that everybody's joining in. I'm really excited by that.
Also, what's amazed me is with the Galsing Fair, it's the quality of the stalls. We've got ceramicists and designers and beautiful jewellery. If you come to buy your Christmas feather, you know you're going to get something that you can't get anywhere else. All the gifts, all the stalls, everything is totally unique, made by the people who live in the surrounding areas. We've got storeholders from Jimena and Ronda and all bringing their... and it's true artisan. And we've got Neil is making his beer and,
Neil's making his beer.
Karen, my darling, Neil's we're going to have to leave you there.
I mean,
everyone will be flocking to Galsing next weekend for the Christmas fair on the 25th. It's 25th anniversary. Thank you so much for joining us and we look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you very much, my darlings, for letting me come on. Have a beautiful day, everybody.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye, Karen.
Bye, Janie.
Bye-bye. Coming up in the next hour, we talk to the Good Samaritan, Janie Jewson. Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens discusses citrus health and meets the oldest living being in Spain, plus a letter from New Jersey with our Brit in America, Andy Wood.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com.
And Penny.
At home. With the Hogs.
Broadcasting to over 500,000 listeners from Mallorca to Gibraltar, you're tuned to Talk Radio Europe. Pen and Kit welcome you back home with the Hogs and with us, Samaritan Janie Jewson.
Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
Good morning. Tell me, what actually is the Samaritans? Because you see it around, you see it advertised, the name. What actually is the aim of the Samaritans?
Well, I have to be honest, before Jilly Hodges came on the radio back in, I think it was April this year, she was talking
about Samaritans.
She came into
the studio.
Here, yes, yeah. She was talking about Samaritans. I didn't really know. I think I was pretty much of the idea that the only purpose it had was like a helpline for those who are feeling suicidal. And in fact, in the very beginning, when it was set up in 1953, it was called 999 for the suicidal. So it was, it was a helpline.
That long ago, 1955?
That long ago, yes.
1953, okay.
That's right. But it has grown since then to an organisation, a charity that is obviously now also set up in Spain, in Costa Blanca, in Torrevieja, I think is the new, is the headquarters, because there's a need here as well. But it's not just phone calls from people who are feeling suicidal. Anybody who is feeling unhappy, distressed, not unhappy, but distressed, really needing someone to talk to who
And they can't talk to their friends, or, you know, they feel they can't talk to their friends.
So why call the Samaritans?
I think, you know, many...
I mean,
many,
it could be, you know, you might not know who you are, or what's the main principle of it?
Well, you would call, you'd pick up the phone to someone when you would, maybe on your own at home, or somewhere else, you're homeless even, you know, might find a phone and call. Because you are grieving, you've lost someone, your life is turned upside down, you can't cope with things. You maybe, you know, are on the edge of bankruptcy, you've got a family to support, or you could even be in a relationship that's abusive or coercively controlling. Anything like that where there's not that connection between yourself and someone else who you feel could really hear you, and understand, to make you feel so less alone in it.
How do I know who's... I mean, do you know who I am? Do I know who you are? I mean, we're looking at each other now, but as if I was to call you now, how do I know you're not going to tell anybody?
Because it's totally confidential.
Oh.
We do not share names. We do not ask for names. We don't give our own name. I mean, sometimes, you know, we'll give a name... may not be our own, but the point is that it is actually it's allowing the person to call to be very free, completely free, to say whatever it is they're feeling, to unwrap, unload that kind of tumble dryer of clothes, if you like, take it out piece by piece, to really sort of lessen the load, fold it all up and put it in a pile, if you see what I'm saying.
That's the analogy.
In a way, yes. It's like you know, we can get so confused and overwhelmed by life and thoughts, and our heads get going, and we're just completely lost. We lose touch with ourselves and the world around us, and it's very, very isolating. So by actually opening up, and talking to someone who's not going to say, oh, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do this, or
so it could just be anybody.
Do
you don't know who it is.
No.
They don't know you. Because if it was me, I would want to be really sure that nobody knew how I was. I mean, you're not going to say, hello, Pen. God. That's confidential.
And, you know, if someone wants to speak to the same person again, but they don't do that. We just put the person who answers the phone is the person they speak to, you know, and it kind of, because every time someone calls, it could be they're feeling different than the time before. So we start over.
Do you learn their name?
Sometimes they give the name, but we don't ask it.
Do you give your name?
I might give my name. I might give my first name, yes.
So they could ask for you?
They could, but they won't get me. Necessarily.
So it's about building a relationship with a counsellor.
No. It's a very much present moment thing.
It's like we're a first aid. Counselors. Like a first aid.
It sort of is. We're not counsellors. We are actually, we're listening. We're listeners. That's what we call ourselves.
Okay.
We're not giving advice. We're not.
You're not giving advice?
No, we don't give advice. But really interestingly, what we find is after... you know, we've been on the phone with someone for a while and they've rung up in a distressed state. By the end of it, they might say, oh, thank you for your advice, but you actually haven't given any.
Oh, really?
Because it's that way of talking and listening to someone where they, in a way, they're listening to themselves talk, if you like. But they're being heard. It's a sort of sounding board. And what we do is we reflect back to them some of the things that they might have said as they're talking along and say, oh, you know, you said that you were really worried about your daughter, for example.
Yeah.
And we take them back to points whereby...
Going back a minute. So you heard Gillie Hodges earlier in the year and you decided that you'd like to become a volunteer. So presumably you've had some kind of training.
Yes.
To train to be a Samaritan. I mean, we'll ask you about how you join and how you become a Samaritan. But what it seems to me is that it's based on confidentiality and trust.
Empathy is the key.
Without that, it just falls to the ground.
Absolutely. And most of the people Well, I'd say that almost everybody who is a volunteer has been in a situation themselves in life where they've needed empathy themselves, and they can empathise more easily than most. They've had a difficult time, you know.
But when you're speaking to somebody as a Samaritan on the telephone, you must then learn and appreciate a unique conversational role that you might not share in a usual connection. In other words, you're speaking rather differently. You're saying you're not offering advice.
No.
You're not offering an opinion.
No.
And you are a sounding board.
You're a sounding board, but you're one that's actively listening. So we'll ask the person to certain questions that will help them to reach down into the feelings that they're having. It's all about discovering how the person is feeling, not for us to discover, but for them to recognise and to know it's all right to feel that thing. Nothing is wrong. Everything is accepted. There's no judgment whatsoever. You know, they might feel really angry about something and somebody, maybe something that's been done to them. We get them to maybe look at that anger. It's a sort of offloading, it's a releasing of the tension around what we all feel sometimes when we hold stuff in.
Do you find yourself talking more about the feeling, more about the emotion,
absolutely,
than the actual empirical circumstance?
Absolutely. What I find is sometimes, I mean, I'm listening to the story, but actually it's what's underlying it that's the most important part. And quite often I will forget stories, you know, later on. Even when I'm talking to people in my daily life, I kind of pick up more what's happening underneath and how they're feeling. And this is all about feelings, because it's really hard nowadays to, you know, just go out of the door and be who you are and express and feel and do everything we need to as human beings. We put a cover over. We actually protect ourselves, and we put on, you know, this kind of... we're all in sort of trying to keep ourselves safe, because to go out and be who you truly are and be that vulnerable and in tune with all your feelings, it makes you feel vulnerable. You know, we put on a tough surface for people out in public.
Of course, we have to act in a considered way, almost in a quasi-political way, don't we?
We all do it. We all pretend to some extent. You know, we'll smile and say we're fine when actually we're feeling diabolical.
So you will take a call. It's an anonymous call. So you're as a volunteer, you're listening to somebody's distress, and you're guiding them through that. So do you yourself feel responsible for that person?
No. I mean, you're obviously responsible for what you say, which is why the training is really, really important.
Okay.
And it can be quite difficult, challenging, let's put it that way.
Well, let's go back to the training, because we haven't been there yet. Tell us.
Okay. Well, first of all, what I did was I went along to an initial meeting, introductory talk, which Jilly and the other volunteers there that started it here gave. So we've got more information. And then I decided, yes, I would like to try to be a volunteer. Not everybody gets accepted because, you know, some people may just not be able to fit it into their lives.
It's quite a commitment, isn't it?
It is a commitment, yes. And you cannot not...
Or may simply not be appropriate. I mean, there has to be a judgment by whoever's in charge.
Exactly, yeah. I mean,
you don't want a rogue Samaritan.
Exactly.
But, I mean, you know, say someone, and we all do it to some extent, someone has always been a fixer. You know, they want to fix people, to, you know, say, well, you go and do that, and you see such and such a person, or why don't you go to the gym, or something like this. That's not what we're here to do, but some people can't get off that train. So you really have to make sure you're not.
Yeah, I
one
find
of those
that really
people.
Hard. Like, what you've got to do is,
And this is why
I've got the answer. Yes.
This is what's interests me. You're training to be passive.
You're training to be a passive, compassionate, empathetic listener. You're listening to that person, probably in a way no one's ever listened to them before, because normally we've got some kind of an agenda when we listen to someone. We want them to be okay. That's the first thing. You know, we're pushing them towards where we want them to be. So actually we feel better about themselves, but actually the direction we're pushing them in isn't necessarily where they want to go. You know, it's about, it's empowering the person to take control over their own lives,
right,
and to feel they can come up with the answers, but they're also listened to, understood, okay, and supported.
Quite a skill. Quite
so,
a skill.
So how do you inherit that skill?
Inherited.
How do you learn that skill? Well, inherit is the wrong word.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you, I mean, although there has to be something inherent within you that makes you able to practice it. How do you learn it?
You learn it through this training process, which is really good, really really good. I was most impressed by it. We have role plays. We have scenarios
over the phone.
No, this is in a group. Sorry. This is in a group.
No, it could be over the phone.
You know, the potential volunteers were all coming in to a room. We had 4 one-day training events, one after the other. There was a selection process at first.
Yeah.
And then you started the training. And we had to go through the process. At the end of the training, you know, you're kind of assessed. And
you can
join
go on
or you don't. Yeah. Yes. And then you're mentored in calls coming in, and you know we then start to take them.
Sorry to be a bit coarse, but do you get paid for this?
Absolutely not. No,
right, just wondering.
No. Yep.
Is all your work over the telephone?
Down here it is in Andalusia. There is another surface, the one where the Costa Blanca
Setup
is. Yes, there's a drop-in centre. There's a phone service. And also throughout Spain, there is email and WhatsApp as well. You can WhatsApp to the number if you want to. The phone service is between 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. every day, 365 days per year.
10 to 10, 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I suppose we ought to ask what the number is.
Ah, the number is, it's a free phone number, and it's 900-525-100.
900-525-100. Interesting.
Yeah.
And so that's 365 days a year, but not at night.
No, at night there is you can email or WhatsApp.
You can, right, okay. Because I would say nighttime's quite a tricky time.
For it is.
Yes,
it
for
is.
Facing your demons. It yeah, is. Yeah. Yes. Those tricky yes. small hours.
It's. I mean, it is established in the UK. There are night. You know, people always manning the phones at night, right the way through the night. As yet, there isn't that set up here. I mean, we get 1,200 plus calls per year here. We're trying to talk about service more.
Which is partly why
exactly,
we're talking now.
Yeah, in order for people to understand, this is a helpline for people in distress, people who are really feeling isolated, just need someone
to have a chat,
to hear them. Okay. Yes.
And lastly, Jenny, is it just in English?
It is just in English.
Okay.
Anybody, any nationality, any age, etc., can call. But we are only an English service. Okay.
Is there a Spanish equivalent? Do you know?
I think there is, Pen, but I'm really sorry, I haven't got
the
number.
That's all right. I mean, it's just general interest.
I actually don't want to wind this up quite yet. I want you to describe the scenario of your work. You've got a session coming up. How long is that session? Where is it? And with whom are you? Are you on your own? You've obviously got a telephone with you.
Okay, first off, it's...
As a volunteer.
A volunteer. We're expected to commit to doing 1 4-hour session per week. At the moment, we're not doing that ourselves, us recent volunteers here, because, you know, we haven't taken the shifts on yet from Costa Blanca. So at the moment, we're covering 4 shifts per week, and they're 4 hours each. So what we do is we're never on our own.
So you turn up at a place?
Oh, we turn up at a place, one of our houses, or there's a room that we can go to.
Okay.
We obviously turn off our own phones. We have these chips that have been given to us by a phone company called Lobster, which we then put into our phones. We use those, the lines are directed to us, and we basically wait for the calls.
You just wait.
We have someone with us. Yeah. Because actually it can be very distressing sometimes for the listener, and it's also mutual support, and also helps when new recruits are coming in to hear you on the phone.
So you work in pairs?
We work in pairs, but, you know, the anonymity of it is absolutely walled in. We do not discuss any of this.
But do you talk to other...
the volunteer group. We have to support one another.
So that's crucial, isn't it?
Now, you did allude to me that when we spoke about this earlier, that there was a question that you always ask.
Yes.
In every conversation, there is one question that you go to.
We do. There are some occasions where it doesn't get to that point because things have become very clear. But we would always ask if someone is feeling that they would like to end their lives.
Mm-hmm.
This is the reason the line was set up in the first place. But it is an important question because it's not something, if someone's really feeling it, that they're going to want to tell anybody.
Mm.
You don't advertise that sort of thing. And it could be underneath that someone to reach that point. Mm. And actually, it's incredible how just bringing that out can help a person.
Mm.
You know, you really feel
almost,
this is the end for you. You know, and you can talk them through and actually they feel held then, you know.
Mm. Excellent, Jenny. Well, tell me one last thing. So you've had a two-hour session and it's maybe been a little bit grueling, but you feel...
Four hours, I'm sorry.
Do you have like a sort of a green room where afterwards you'll discuss the case just with your companion so that you can offload us?
Absolutely. I was going to ask that. Yeah. The come down.
We would normally talk with the person with us, yes. And just it gets left when you leave that room. It doesn't go anywhere. Any notes are thrown away, torn up, thrown away.
Right.
We don't share them. We give a very brief rundown. You know, someone called distressed in such and such a way to HQ, and that's really for statistics. You know, since we've got the numbers.
Yeah.
And then we would share that we'd had a phone call with the rest of our group here, just saying that, and send it out in a WhatsApp. And then we have the opportunity, if we wish and need to talk to anyone within that group, if we're feeling distressed, and lots of people do feel a little distressed afterwards.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
You know, we've heard some stuff, some you know, heavy stuff sometimes.
Mm.
Jenny, thank you very much. It's been really nice having you on the phone not on the phone, actually in the studio, even better.
Live, you're making phone call,
But the word phone came to mind because I do think we should repeat that number.
Yes, 900-525-100. And, of course, you can look it up online at
SamaritansInSpain.es,
I think, yes?
It would come up anyway.
That's right. And on there you would also see information that can lead you to, if you want to email anything you want to discuss to the group or WhatsApp.
Cool.
Thank you.
Let's have a little bit of Johnny Cash, shall we? Thank you so much, Jenny Juice.
You're welcome.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at SpainTree.com. At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they?
And scatter the good seed on the land, but it is fed and watered by God's almighty hand. He sends the snow in winter, the worms to smell the grain, the breezes and the sunshine, and soft, refreshing rain.
and soft, refreshing rain. We actually had some soft, refreshing rain. How happy are we? Welcome to the part of the program we call Arbalistas, Palms, Trees and Gardens. And if you want to get involved, then do call us on 952 78 4000, particularly today, because if you are a Mediterranean gardener and from pot plant to finca, let's face it, most of us are, we deal with the possibility, it's possibly the most common inquiry on the phone to Arbalista, porque cuando canta el pajarito, which means when the phone rings, it's more often than not a question of citrus health, a problem with an orange, grapefruit, mandarin or lemon growing in your garden that the punter wants to know about. So let's look at some of those symptoms, their causes, and if possible, identify their cures. Now, I know Pengy's been busy researching all week. I mean, not that she didn't know it all already.
We know it all.
I think perhaps, I think what we can do is get the weather out of the way first.
Okay.
Because many of us assume that a tree is infested with some beech or other when, for example, it's suffered sunburn or, I mean, hot, dry winds will shrivel leaves and twigs, or more seasonally appropriate right now, frost will burn leaves dead, leaving them scorched and still attached. And generally, lemons have a lower tolerance to frost than oranges. And I remember that clearly from the winter of 2004, when we lost loads of lemons and the oranges survived due to extremely cold temperatures down in the valley. So meteorological events are relatively easy to identify, and generally if a tree is healthy, just like us, it is able to withstand and recover from a climatic setback. So leaf colour, of course, it's a major indicator of plant health, a bit like when your hair goes sort of dull, or your skin looks bad.
Yeah, a dog's coat is dull or coming out.
But as with the effect of the weather, it may have nothing to do with a pest or disease. It can be about diet, for example, i.e. soil condition.
Okay.
And I will just give one example of a necrosis, which is the yellowing of leaves. I mean, that's due to poor soil, it's due to nitrogen deficiency, mm-hmm. and a lack of potassium, for example, manifests itself with yellowing and a slight curling of the leaf. So you wanted to talk about soil conditioning.
I did actually. Okay, so the most valuable information that I can impart is, first of all, wind scorch actually is quite a big factor. You know, you can say, oh, it literally wind scorch. The wind can scorch leaves. It can just literally just burn them off. But I've got a list here of five things which really, I think we're going to combat pest and disease. The most important thing, like you said, is the good grounding. Your, like, the immune system of the tree can shun most pests and diseases if it has the following. First of all, some kind of mulch.
Okay, now, so are we talking about the roots here? Are we talking about about the ground that the tree is growing in? This is what interests
below ground level, yes. I mean, if you look at something like honey fungus, if you've got other fungus in the soil provided within the mulch, it's going to be a lot less prevalent. You don't want scalped lawns. You don't want scalped soil. You want nice, juicy mulch. Leaf matter, compost, vegetable compost, tierra vegetal, which you might have bought, just nice loamy stuff around the base, the whole of the base of the tree, below the drip line of the tree. That's number one.
So don't tidy up too much.
Tidy up. And we saw this article, and it's in the Sunday Times last week, and it's so true. I mean, insect life is crucial to tree life. It really is. You know, so if you have leaf blowers, for example, which are just complete waste of money, time, energy, the noise, leave the leaves.
Well, what would the gardeners do without a leaf blower?
Well, what they used to do 10 years ago, you know, rake or just make piles and leave habitat.
Well,
I mean, without insects, you don't have hedgehogs, you don't have lizards. Anyway, we're done harping on about that. But for trees, that's really important. The second thing is compaction. Compaction is absolutely lethal for any plant. So you have to keep the base of the tree aerated so you can get the air in there. I mean, soil is something, or should be, and that we have problems with this at the moment, 60% air. The air has got to be able to get into the soil. So you've got your microbes, your bacteria, your insect life, all of that has got to be able to function juicily and deliciously within the soil.
In among those particles.
In amongst the particles. You can't breathe if it's like squidge, sorry about the noises, but you know seeds can't
is that a noise for compaction?
Yes, it is. You know, if you just try and dig it just makes it suffocating. You know, compaction is suffocating. So
Jenny, did you want to say something?
Sorry, so I've got my third point. I'm just going to make a little point there. Yeah.
Oh, she doesn't want to interrupt her. Sorry.
So, but how do you know if a tree is got, I mean, a tree grows, like, for example, on my place, you know, with just this clay soil all around it, trees growing up.
And they're doing very well.
And they're doing fine.
Yes, but your land is not over-cleaned.
Yeah,
you know, you've
true.
Got leaves there. You haven't been spraying it. You haven't been mowing it. You haven't been watering. It's left to its own devices. It's got its own little microclimate.
It has, whereas just outside, where
it's
all
dead.
The new avocado trees have been growing for 6 years, it looks like a desert.
Well,
and
it is.
Some of those
yes.
trees are dying.
Yeah, it's just...
Particularly in that clay.
So the third point...
The third point,
yes,
going, yes.
I can't count anymore, never mind.
One
tiny little thing, that if it's a recent planting, check the tree ties. Check that your tree is not being strangled by a tree tie. It sounds... I mean, I was parked in our village the other day, and looked around these new planting plane trees. They've got these tight wires around the bark, like, and it's just strangling the tree. It's so obvious.
Yeah.
Loosen them off. Take them out if the tree is established. 4, root collars killing. Tell us about planting a tree and root collars and how.
Well, I mean, it's very, very basic.
Must be able to breathe.
Yes, and it's proactive. When you plant a tree, you plant a tree at the level that it naturally grows out of the ground. In other words, the roots are supposed to be under the ground and the stem is supposed to be above the ground. But people mistakenly plant, they're too lazy to dig a hole, possibly, and therefore they plant the tree too high, in which case fragile roots are exposed to the air.
Yeah, and, so easily done.
But equally, you can plant too deep, in which case you can set up a suffocation around the stem.
So okay. You said root collar first. That's a particular line.
Yes, it is, and it's quite easy to see. It's where the natural, where the trunk finishes and the roots begin.
Okay.
So a natural swelling and fluting of the root system.
So you would plant to the level of the top of the root.
Yes, you would.
First root.
Yes.
Okay. Not like on, again, back to my land, where there was already a tree, a beautiful pine tree, and to flatten the land. That guys bought along this great diggerfuls of soil and loaded up around the tree trunk so that the actual tree trunk was buried by a metre.
Yes.
And
what's happened? And what's happened to that
tree? 10 years later, the tree's dead and I had to call you guys in to cut it down.
Well, it does take time, but eventually... The reason is that the tree bark has little holes in it, and those holes are called lenticels, and those lenticels admit oxygen to the vascular tissue that connects the canopy with the root system, the phloem and the xylem. And if those holes are blocked, then that tissue will basically rot.
Which is why you dug out all that soil when your finca got flooded from around the trees. And to save them, basically.
Yes, and why the ones that we didn't get to have died.
Okay,
or
got
are
it.
Dying, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, we're not really talking about pests and diseases here, are we? It's a huge subject. We'll have to carry on with this next week. What we're talking about, though, is being proactive and creating a condition that a tree
creates
can...
Creates a healthy tree.
Like, if you're a healthy person and you've got a good diet, chances are that you withstand a common cold. Or something more serious.
Or you can have a common cold, but it doesn't go,
it doesn't turn into something else. So if you create the right conditions for a healthy tree, then your tree is going to resist pests and diseases. And 90% of tree problems occur below ground. So we're absolutely right to talk about soil condition and healthy roots. This is the basis of a healthy tree.
Another thing that I think is important, which not everybody does, but no overhead watering is something that I've discovered recently. If you're watering your trees, make sure that, and they're young, that the leaf canopy is not wet and then drips down on into the soil, because if there's any bacteria established in the crown of the tree, it can drop. It can just basically spread it. I mean, it sounds sort of obvious, but that's the way. The second and the last thing is basically happy pruning. You know, if you've got an open crown, no dead or diseased or crowded branches within a tree, you're going to have really a healthier tree, aren't you? If it can have air and circulation within that crown.
That's right. So we've talked about what's going on below ground. We're going to have aerated roots. We're going to have roots that are fed with an organic fertilizer. Above ground, we're talking about a canopy that is open, like an open hand, and does not have clutter, because clutter produces conditions that are ideal for sooty mold, for example, aphid infestation, and other pests and diseases that we will be talking about next week. So what we've tried to do this week is to create a healthy situation for a tree.
Start.
Yeah. The other thing I will say before we close is placement. Placement is really important.
Yeah.
If you're planting right now, and now is the time to plant.
We are all planting, aren't we?
It's
got to be done.
Be careful about where you, and we're talking citrus, don't plant a citrus on the north side of the house. Plant a citrus unless citrus like full light.
Okay.
And people, I'll go and see a poor lemon tree that gets virtually no sun at all during the winter. And the reason is it's on the north side of the house. It's cold, damp, leaves are curled. There's a lot of sooty mold. Mm. So beware of that. Placement is important. Great. Janie, one more?
No. I was just going to say there have been some incredible winds down here recently. Are you going to be expecting to... get lots of calls?
Very unlikely. Most of the big trees have been cut down, I'm afraid. That's the sad fact. Anyway, that is all for Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens, because after this, we are going to America to talk to Andy Wood.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
It's off to the USA now, because it's time to welcome our Brit in America, Andy Wood, with this month's letter from New Jersey. And a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. Hogg. And nice to hear you, Miss Jewson.
Good morning, Andy.
I gather you've got a bit of a frosty one there up in New Jersey.
Yeah, it's a crystal clear morning, but it's -4 today, so it's pretty chilly.
Is it daylight yet? Oh, yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. We put the clocks back 2 weeks ago, so it gets light pretty early.
Right, and I want to leave New Jersey for the moment, and I want you to take us to Düsseldorf in Germany, because you've just come from something that is not a Christmas fair. We talked about Christmas fairs earlier. Neither seasonal nor in New Jersey, the Düsseldorf Medical Fair. Tell us about that, because you said earlier it's the biggest fair in the world or something, the biggest medical fair in Europe or something.
Düsseldorf does have a beautiful Christmas market, actually, a very traditional one.
Did you go there as well?
Yeah, we popped down and have a look. It opened on Thursday, actually. That was the first night.
Mm-hmm.
But the Germany's very good at managing monster events. So they have what they call them fairgrounds, but it's basically 17 aeroplane hangars connected to each other by walkways. And they're just full of medical equipment. It's the largest medical show in the world. So if you had a big, giant, empty building and wanted to make it into a hospital, you could just go there and buy everything. industrial washing machines, EKGs, everything except pharmaceuticals. No.
Okay, so no drugs.
No drugs.
No, give us a sense of the range of stuff that's the range of stuff that's on.
Well, we're in Hall 4. Our stand is in Hall 4, which is all physical therapy and rehabilitation. So we're surrounded by treadmills, and we're surrounded by things to help you get back to work or get back to sport, underwater treadmills, bars, massage devices, traction devices. And then you go to another hall, and it'll be all x-ray, all imaging, giant GE machines. They bring in MRI machines, the latest PET scanners. Another hall will be all software. You go in there, they explain to you what they do, and you still don't understand. A couple of halls are all labs. So they have massive, analytical machines. There's no conferences, and there's no doctors or nurses. It's purely business to business for people around the world who deal in this kind of
So who are the buyers, Andy?
Basically, they are in-country distribution partners. So they would be like the... I met a guy from Malaga, actually, funnily enough. Uh-huh. And he has a small company that supplies physical therapy, chiropractors along throughout Andalusia and actually into Morocco. So he would bring in tables and chairs and different treatment devices, and then he would supply them to hospitals and clinics locally.
So yeah. He's just a middleman.
Yeah,
the wholesaler. Distributors.
Yeah, right. Distributors.
And some of them are manufacturers as well. I mean, it's a dynamic world. There's a lot of complexity, but basically, yes.
So, Andy, here's the question now. What were you doing there?
My company, we had a stand in Hall 4, maybe 15 by 15 meter display. And we had some devices on, and we were targeting some particular countries where we don't have representation.
Yes, go on. The devices. So we don't know what you do, what you're selling.
Tell us. Some meetings to discuss with some people who do already. We handle our product. I met with our Indian distributor. I met with our Kuwaiti distributor. I met with our Canadian distributor.
So we had meetings
with those people, and then we looked for distributors in countries that we don't have.
Oh, I think I should be one. Andy, can you tell us what you sell? I know it's laser, and I know this is probably catching you off the hoof slightly, but actually it'd be really interesting to know, health-wise, what it is that you sell.
Well, very, very briefly, series of devices about the size of a toaster that put out a very high power laser light, infrared light. You can't see it. And we sell that to veterinarians for dogs, cats, and horses, and also to rehab, to people who treat musculoskeletal injuries to speed healing, reduce pain.
Okay.
We got most of the professional teams in the U.S. I'm very excited about our inroads into the English Premier League. So we now have about half a dozen teams using it. Yeah, including the mighty Bristol Rovers, my team.
I have a signed
shirt from them, actually.
How cool is that? Did you make that sale?
No, I didn't. My friend did, and he knew that I grew up with that great team, prepared you for disappointment in life if you support the Rovers. And so he got them to sign a shirt, and we framed it and put it in our office. But we have Watford and West Ham use our laser. Wolverhampton Wanderers use it. Wrote a nice article in the football press about
Andy,
it.
Andy.
Newcastle using it.
So. Andy. It sounds very worldwide and marvellous, but can you tell me what it... I mean, you say laser. I think of lasers kind of, like laser eye surgery and getting tumours or whatever, and, you know, like kidney stones and stuff. What does laser do to skeletal muscle?
Well,
whatever
basically, laser will penetrate deep into the tissue if it's the right wavelength and if it's delivered appropriately. And if you think, to give you an analogy that might be appropriate for you guys, if you think about photosynthesis, leaves, plants take light and turn it into food, right? Into protein, into starches.
Okay.
And so your cells are capable of absorbing certain wavelengths. becoming excited and effectively, if you can remember way back to sleeping through the Krebs cycle in biology class, it basically increases ATP, which repairs cell and causes cell energy. So, I don't want to put your listeners to sleep, but you did ask.
So it's the opposite of laser eye surgery, which cuts.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Different way. The wavelengths. That's exactly right. The wavelengths they use in laser eye surgery are way out in the infrared spectrum, in the electromagnetic spectrum, and that wavelength is incredibly well absorbed by water, so it doesn't penetrate. It just fries the very surface of your eye.
Okay. So laser. The effect of laser depends on wavelength.
Correct. Correct. 100% correct.
Okay. Fascinating. I'm absolutely.
Everybody's asleep.
No, absolutely not.
No, okay. People, I've always meant to ask you.
People love. Our listeners love medical stuff, Andy, because we're all we're all getting on a little bit. You know, we're all starting to think.
All right, gotcha.
Yeah, well, this
well, I certainly
laser
think
could be good.
The sting out of arthritis. So, right. So definitely
great, Andy. Let's go over to the States now. We talk about Thanksgiving next weekend. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the fourth weekend in November.
You get excited about that. This is your first Thanksgiving actually as an American.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
Is Thanksgiving... I want to talk to you about voting in a moment, but is Thanksgiving mainly a white thing? How are other communities taking on?
Not really. It's the only four-day holiday, so it has a wonderful, everybody likes it. So the other thing is that it's ecumenical. You know, we have 10% of the population are Jewish. They don't really feel included in Christmas, whereas this involves everybody. I think the Native Americans possibly take a dim view, but everybody else, black, white, yellow, green, all really like Thanksgiving.
Yes, well, a four-day holiday is not too hard to take, really, is it? I mean,
right, exactly.
So, but the typical Thanksgiving meal, we've spoken a little bit about food on this program already today.
It's turkey, isn't it?
It's it's kind of like a super duper Christmas dish with sweet potatoes, isn't
correct.
It, or something.
Correct, sweet potatoes typically. Basically, the traditional thing is a cranberry sauce stuffing. Sweet potatoes, maybe a pecan pie, and then drink a lot of beer and fall asleep watching the football game.
Andy,
I love pecan pie.
Sorry, Andy. Does that same meal take place on Christmas Day?
Very similar, yeah, although different ethnic groups have different traditions on Christmas, but yeah, it's if you're of an Anglo background, Thanksgiving and Christmas are pretty much interchangeable as far as food goes.
Okay.
Now, we spoke to you last, and you just become a US citizen, having lived in the country for how long was it? How long have you lived?
28 years, I think.
Yeah, which is of course interesting to us because we're all kind of expatriates, and what with Brexit and stuff, I know some people are going after Spanish citizenship, and you've just voted. How was that?
Yeah.
What did you vote? What was the vote?
Well, there was it's interesting here. It was what they call an off-year vote. So it was it was local. So we voted for a New Jersey state representative and then some local township committee men, like councillors, I guess would be the thing. And we also voted for sheriff. Let's vote for the sheriff.
Ah, brilliant. And, right.
The Board of Education. We voted for too.
So is this sheriff? I would have. I'm surprised that's a Democratic appointment. I would have thought the sheriff was an internal police department affair.
Yeah, and I did too. So before this before talking to you, I asked about that. The sheriff's department is responsible for prisoner transport and security within the courthouse system. So it's a pretty big law enforcement group, but it's very specific. And I said, why are we voting for sheriff? It makes no sense. Well, you know, the history is that these would be political appointees, old cronies giving it to their friends. So it was taken out of that and given to the people to try and avoid the old boys club.
To give us a feeling of who actually stood for sheriff in your locality, were you aware of the candidature?
Not really. I mean, I knew that the existing guy was running, but no, not really. The names were kind of meaningless and has very little information locally.
It didn't quicken the blood.
That was 12% turnout.
Right, it wasn't
really. So people take a lot of interest. I will tell you one interesting thing. Going back to the medical fair, which is sort of related, is that as we were walking, thousands and thousands of people walking down the street, there was a guy handing out pamphlets, and I took one off him, and it was a picture of Trump, and it said there are 345 U.S. companies in the Medica pavilions. Boycott them. It's the only way President Trump will rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Right. And Trump, of course, engaged in a process at the moment that we kind of hear about. We're running out of time, but very briefly, how spicy is that in the States? It presumably is
drawing
quite a lot of
interest. Well, we all have impeachment fatigue right now.
Oh, you do? Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's 24/7. But impeachment is not a trial. It's an article in the Constitution, and it allows the House of Representatives to have basically an indictment to make a case, and then the trial would go to the Senate. And they're saying that he was using the office of the presidency for his own political ends, and that is considered one of the high crimes and misdemeanors.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're running out of time. But this hearing, if he is found to have been erroneous, guilty, in other words, is not the end of him necessarily.
It would go to the Senate where there is a Republican majority. It wouldn't be the end of him, but he will still be only the fourth president in history to have been through the process.
We'll see what happens.
History will be a critical judge.
We're going to have to leave you now, and thank you so much for joining us. Have the most excellent weekend.
Have a beautiful weekend, and hope your listeners enjoy one too. Thanks again.
Bye, man.
Thank you, Andy.
Bye-bye.
That's all we have time for. Thanks to our guests, of course. That's Janie Jewson and Karen O'Connor and Andy Wood there in New Jersey. We've been Penn and Kit. You've been at Home with the Hogs. Take good care, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week, guys.
Just time to hear Bertie the Blackbird.
No.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.